content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled "The Haunting of Young George Washington" by David L. Preston. New evidence helps resolve enduring mysteries about a 1758 skirmish that nearly cost the future president his life and shaped his views on the battles yet to come. For the rest of his life, George Washington would remember the chaos and tragedy of November 12, 1758. At 26, he was the colonel commanding the Virginia Regiment, a British subject fighting for his king in the conflict known as the French and Indian War. The soldiers were advancing westward in a campaign to take the Ohio Valley from the French and their native allies. The troops had crossed the Appalachians and built a fort called Loyalhanna in what is now western Pennsylvania, about 50 miles east of Fort Duquesne, the strategic French outpost they planned to conquer. In the October 2019 issue of Smithsonian, I wrote about a 1754 document I discovered in the British National Archives, an eyewitness account from an Ohio Iroquois warrior who identified Washington as having fired the first shot in the skirmish that sparked the war. Now, as British troops closed in on the Ohio Valley, Washington was about to play a key role in the conflict's end. On that Sunday in November 1758, the British commander, General John Forbes, got word that a French and Indian scouting party was approaching Loyalhanna. After he sent a unit of Virginians into the woods, the roar of muskets was loud enough that Forbes sent Washington out with reinforcements. In the dusky light and confusion, each of the two Virginia parties mistook the other for the enemy. The skirmish would come to be known as the quote-unquote friendly fire incident, and Washington was largely responsible for restoring order. He placed himself between the two Virginia units, knocking the soldiers' muskets upward with his sword and commanding them to stop firing. By the time the shooting ceased, as many as 16 Virginians were dead and more than 20 others were wounded. Washington came out unscathed, but in his orderly book, he noted that his soldiers marched out the next morning. They were to, quote, carry a proportion of spades in order to bury the dead, end quote. 13 days later, the British captured Fort Duquesne and with it control of Ohio Valley on Virginia's western frontier. But Washington remained haunted. In 1787, jotting down his personal reflections for a biographer, the soon-to-be president wrote that his life had never been, quote, in as much jeopardy before or since, end quote, that moment in the Pennsylvania woods. By that time, everybody knew about Washington's courage during the Revolutionary War. In 1776, he led 2,400 men across the Delaware River as sleet rained down and ice floes drifted past in the darkness. But at Loyalhanna, Washington wrote, he'd faced, quote, more imminent danger, end quote. Yet the friendly fire incident had rarely earned more than a passing glance in the many biographies of Washington. The details and location remained unknown, even as sites all over the United States boasted that Washington slept, dined, or worshipped there. Between the shame of fratricide and the urgency of reaching Fort Duquesne, the soldiers themselves spent little time recording or investigating the event. The mass grave of the 16 dead Virginians was never marked or memorialized. As the battle became the stuff of Western Pennsylvania legend, it was up to local historians to uncover the reality. The Fort Ligonier Museum and Historic Site, nestled in Pennsylvania's Laurel Highlands, has played a crucial role. Shortly after the friendly fire incident, Forbes named Loyalhanna in honor of John Ligonier, the commander-in-chief of the British Army. The original fort no longer stands, but in the 1940s and 50s, archaeologists conducted excavations and began a stunningly accurate reconstruction of the fort at its original location, using period plans and maps. Visitors can stand at the recreated Western Battery and imagine the monumental labor of building a fort or moving supply wagons through the mountains. In 2008, the museum acquired the handwritten manuscript of the first president's biographical remarks from 1787. Quote, telling a story like the Friendly Fire incident, says Matt Galt, the fort's director of education, humanizes Washington and makes him relatable, end quote. Archaeology and history have always gone hand in hand at the Fort Ligonier Museum. Board trustee Charles Fagan III, who died in 2025, made it a lifelong mission to investigate the Friendly Fire incident, given its importance to Fort Ligonier's story. Written accounts, however, offered only vague hints of the incident's exact location. One soldier's journal placed it in a valley behind a mountain, which could have described almost any site in the vicinity. Fagan suspected that the skirmish had occurred a few miles west of Loyalhanna along Forbes's Road, an old pathway whose traces are still visible. But only archaeologists would be able to locate the site with precision and certainty. In 2021, Fort Ligonier's executive director, Mary Manges, asked archaeologists to find the Friendly Fire location. Jonathan Burns, an anthropologist at nearby Wanyata College, has extensive experience excavating 18th century sites and in the field of conflict archaeology. He also led the Veterans Archaeology Program, an initiative that helps U.S. military veterans explore careers related to archaeology and public history. He knew that the members of this team would bring an extra layer of insight because of their combat experience. In 2022, the team followed Fagan's hunch and began digging near Forbes Road. Sure enough, the evidence began to emerge. Quote, it was a visceral rush once our team began recovering mid-18th century artifacts scattered across the fields, end quote, Burns said. Quote, that ultimately meant that we were locating and documenting the battle actions of that infamous day in history, end quote. By the time the dig began, I'd spent years poring over documents as I worked on a book about Washington's early life. The only verified eyewitness accounts of the Friendly Fire incident were Washington's own writings, his 1758 orderly book, and the 1787 reflections. There are secondhand accounts drawn from officers and men who had remained at Loyalhanna in 1758, a Pennsylvania German soldier, a Scottish Highland officer, and Forbes. Some of Forbes's officers contributed reports to colonial newspapers, such as the Pennsylvania Gazette. I was also surprised to discover how many papers in Great Britain had covered the Friendly Fire incident. Even though the story has been mostly lost to history, at the time it was international news. I began visiting the site and consulting with Burns as well as the Fort Ligonier staff. After years of reading about the incident, it was a thrill to see the 18th century objects coming up to the surface, bullets, buttons, buckles, musket parts, and iron hardware. As Burns' team members found each item, they plotted its exact coordinates on a digital map. The spatial patterns revealed important details, such as the size of the battlefield and the location of the firing lines. The variety of buttons and personal effects unearthed at the site provide a tangible human connection to the often unnamed soldiers who labored and fought in 1758. One of the most compelling early finds was a copper watch key with a fleur-de-lis design, lost by a French or British officer who would have had a watch in the wilderness. The Virginia provincials not only didn't wear standard uniforms, but also often looked like civilians. One officer at the time had noted that some soldiers wore blue coats, while others were quote-unquote in rags. He described one soldier as wearing a light-colored cloth waistcoat and check trousers. Greg Williams, a Navy veteran and Smithsonian staff member who was working at the dig site, uncovered a square copper shoe buckle fragment of a civilian variety, most likely belonging to a provincial soldier. When I visited the site in July, the heat didn't seem to faze the veterans. One kept digging through a downpour, shouting out the old army saying, quote, if it ain't raining, we ain't training, end quote. I spent much of my time with David Williams, an army veteran who received the combat infantryman badge during his service in Iraq. As he swung the long shaft of a Minelab Manticore metal detector, His Midas touch never failed. On his last day at the site this past summer, he made a rare find. 3 dropped musket balls of French caliber on the ground where the French and Indian forces fought the Virginians. Quote, as a combat veteran, he told me, knowing what happened here brings you closer to the site and makes it more personal, end quote. One of my own projects has been to reconstruct the French perspective on the battle at Loyalhanna. Using documents that other historians had never consulted, I pieced together secondhand accounts from French officers and one by the French Canadian Governor General, who fixed the skirmish location a few miles west of Loyalhanna. The Marquis de Vaudreuil told his superiors in Paris that the Belle Rivière, Ohio River, was of, quote, infinite importance to the state and especially to the colony, end quote, and he closely monitored the events there in the fall of 1758. For the French, the Friendly Fire incident was a turning point in the struggle for the Ohio Valley. The commanding officer at Fort Duquesne, Captain François-Marie Le Marchand de Lignerie, had been asked while with repairing with crumbling edifice of French power in the Ohio Valley, both literally and figuratively. Years of floods had rendered Fort Duquesne indefensible, yet through most of 1758, the French and their native allies had bested the British in battle. In September, they had destroyed a large British reconnaissance force led by Major James Grant, a battle that became known as Grant's Defeat. The French followed the victory in October with a spoiling attack on Loyalhanna, designed to destroy supplies and capture livestock so that the British advance would grind to a halt. But by mid-October, Lignery no longer had enough rations to sustain his garrison beyond 18 days, let alone provide gifts and supplies to his native allies. Most of his troops left Fort Duquesne, and discouraged native allies drifted away. But the officer was determined to keep pressure on the British, as he informed his superiors, quote, I have not ceased for a month to have scouting done in the neighborhood at Loyalhanna, end quote. As Lignery sent out another party in early November, he hoped his men could prevent the British from attacking Fort Duquesne for the rest of the year. According to Van Drieu's letter, a party of 30 French Canadians, along with 140 Shawnee, Delaware, and Haudenosaunee, Iroquois, warriors set out for Loyalhanna on November 9th. Their leader, Lieutenant Claude-Louis de Colbière, was a master of woodland warfare with native allies. By 1758, he had destroyed several British forces in battle. Yet by the time his group approached Loyalhanna, it had dwindled to around 50 Canadians and Indians. Without knowing that Corbière's party was on its way, Forbes met with his principal officers at Loyalhanna on November 11th. They acknowledged a hard truth. The cold weather was causing supply shortages and turning the roads into soupy rivers of mud. The campaign would have to be suspended and the army would winter at Loyalhanna, as the Ohio Valley would remain in French hands. Washington had been pessimistic about the campaign from the start, and he observed that, quote, nothing but a miracle can procure success, end quote. The next day, the British learned from their own scouts, or guards tending nearby cattle, that the French were approaching with a party of around 200. The first group Forbes sent out was more than a match. About 500 Virginians, led by Lieutenant Colonel George Mercer of the 2nd Virginia Regiment. Mercer was a close confidant of Washington's, having served under him since 1754. He had fought by Washington's side in many battles and been his principal aide. Mercer and his men likely marched out of Loyalhanna with high confidence. Many of these Virginians had fought alongside their own native allies, and some were outfitted, quote, after the Indian fashion, end quote, according to one Virginia officer, sporting match coats, blankets, leggings, moccasins, and tomahawks. Sure enough, the archaeological dig has unearthed a wide variety of buttons and other clothing elements at the site. The motley assortment of Virginia uniforms would have contributed to the confusion of the battle. The November sky was beginning to darken as the Virginians headed westward, gaining a high ridge and descending into a valley where they made initial contact with the French and Indian patrol. As Washington waited back at the camp, he later recalls the sounds of, quote, severe conflict and hot firing, end quote, seemed to be getting closer, as though Mercer's men were being pushed back. Forbes wanted to surround the French and native patrol and had authorized Washington to call for volunteers. The relief force presumably took a different route than Mercer's men had taken since Washington planned to envelop the enemy. The Virginians advanced toward the sounds of gunshots. But when the firing ceased, Washington sent scouts ahead to let Mercer know that they were approaching. The message did not reach all of Mercer's men, perhaps because they dispersed so widely as they fought the French. By the time the sun disappeared behind the mountains, Mercer's men had been fighting the French and native force for about an hour. Mercer's initial attack was apparently successful. The Virginians had pushed back Corbière's force up an elevated shelf of ground. The French and Indians had taken position behind trees and rocks, intending to withdraw under cover of darkness. Archaeologists have found a pattern of bullets concentrated on that very shelf, including three unspent musket balls, which were perhaps dropped by a wounded or retreating French or native fighter. Corbière and his allies were savvy veterans of wilderness warfare. Though heavily outnumbered, they had preserved their line of retreat. As they broke off contact and headed west towards Fort Duquesne, Mercer's Virginians managed to capture three prisoners, including a native man and woman. There is no discussion in the sources about the native woman, who she was, or what she was doing in the party. That was when Washington's relief force burst onto the scene, quote, approaching in another direction, end quote, as Washington later recalled. Fearing that the French and natives had circled back for a counterattack, Mercer's men opened fire. Darkness, as well as clouds of smoke from the musketry, obscured visibility in the valley. Washington's men saw Mercer's group and assumed they had surrounded the enemy. The presence of native prisoners might have even added to the confusion. The Whitehall Evening Post in London reported that the relief unit began shooting, quote, on seeing our people with Indians, amongst them about the fire, end quote. The roar of musketry erupted once again as lead balls thudded into trees, rocks, and human flesh. Washington quickly realized the mistake and began running between the two sides, presumably on foot, ordering his men to cease firing and knocking their muskets up with his sword. Officers began to restore order, a difficult task as many soldiers were likely scattered among the trees rather than in dense ranks. A round tore through the arm and chest of Harry Townsend, a soldier in Washington's Virginia regiment. One of Mercer's men, Sergeant Thomas Brannan, suffered a severe wound in the neck that left him with impaired eyesight. Two officers were killed, including a volunteer who had gone out with Washington, Lieutenant John Evans of the 60th Regiment. John Michael Lindenmuth, a Pennsylvania German soldier who had remained back at the fort, described the quote-unquote pitiful condition of the men who stumbled back, but the names of the casualties were not recorded in any known document. Officers and interpreters interrogated the three prisoners. One turned out to be an Englishman named Richard Johnson. Originally a farmer living in Paxton Township in Pennsylvania, he may have lived and traded among the Ohio Indians before the war, but the Indians had taken him captive in 1757. Now the British officers informed Johnson that, as he had been found, quote, in arms against his king and country, he had thereby forfeited his life, end quote, unless he was willing to reveal what he knew of the enemy's situation. If the British found any redemption from the fratricide near Loyalhanna, it came from Johnson's intelligence. He told his interrogators that Fort Duquesne was desperately weak and undermanned. There is no record of whether Johnson was executed or pardoned, but his crucial information proved to be the miracle that Washington thought was needed to bring success. Forbes ordered his army to resume its march on Fort Duquesne, a bold decision that allowed his soldiers to redeem tragedy with forward progress. Before the group could move on, though, Lindenmuth recorded in his journal that, quote, we buried our dead with sorrowful hearts, end quote. Forbes captured Fort Duquesne without a fight on November 25th, renaming it Pittsburgh in honor of British statesman William Pitt. France's Delaware, Shawnee, and Ohio Iroquois allies were forced to accept a new British presence, along with an uncertain future. Meanwhile, the colony of New France was collapsing under relentless British attacks. Lignery was mortally wounded in 1759 near Fort Niagara, and Corbière died from his wounds after the 1760 Battle of Sainte-Foy outside Quebec. On the British side, Forbes, who had been ill throughout the campaign, died shortly after returning to Philadelphia in early 1759. Brannan and Townsend of the Virginia Provincials suffered from their wounds long after the war. Unable to make a living, they both petitioned the Virginia House of Burgesses for relief. Poignantly, both former commanders, Washington and Mercer, were on the legislative committee that reviewed and approved the petitions. As compensation of their injuries, Brannan appeared to receive a one-time payment of £10, while Townsend received £10 per year. Mercer was a legislator and land agent for the colonies after the war, but when the American Revolution broke out, he remained a loyalist and died in London in 1784. Still, when Washington looked back at the incident after the Revolutionary War, he referred warmly to his friend Colonel Mercer. After four seasons of sifting through dirt and evidence, Burns and the Fort Ligonier leadership announced in July 2025 that they had discovered the exact location of the Friendly Fire incident. By that time, they found nearly 400 artifacts and what Burns regarded as a significant victory for battlefield archaeology. The concentration and spatial distribution of both fired and unfired musket balls allowed them to pinpoint the battle site, as well as the general locations of the British and French and Indian forces. Written records reveal no other skirmishes in the area that could have produced such a volume of gunfire. Along such an extended front, archaeological investigations continue, especially the search for the Virginian's mass grave. The team has used specially trained archaeology dogs that can detect even the smallest human remains. This past spring, Burns and his colleague Ryan Mother at Uniata College tested the musket balls for their chemical isotopes, specific variations of molecules that relieve their geological origin. The lead in the musket balls came from either Europe or the French sources in Canada and the Far West. This last finding lined up with French documents, which reported that Fort Duquesne increasingly relied on men's supplies and munitions coming from Illinois down the Ohio River. The calibers of British and French ammunition uncovered at the site also revealed the weaponry used by the combatants, ranging from French Toul, Saint-Étienne, and British Longland Pattern, Brown Bess, muskets to trade muskets that native warriors would have carried. The British musket balls have matched 18th century descriptions of the Virginia provincials' weaponry, a motley mix of firearms with some dating back to the 1720s. Ongoing excavations, as well as private property concerns, prevent me from revealing the exact location of the site. But after years of watching the team's progress, I shared in the satisfaction of discovery. I knew how profoundly the events of November 1758 shaped the man who would become the commander of the Continental Army. They included both the heights and the depths of Washington's military career in the French and Indian War. During the final march on Fort Duquesne, Forbes honored him with the temporary title of Brigadier as he commanded the advance brigade. When Washington posed for Charles Wilson Peale's 1772 portrait of himself as a Virginia officer in the Ohio Valley, he had his 1758, quote, order of the march, quote, proudly sticking out of his waistcoat pocket. Washington stopped fighting for the British after the capture of Fort Duquesne. He turned his gaze back east towards marriage to the widow Martha Custis and a new political career in the Virginia legislature that became the crucible of his growing resistance to British policies. The Friendly Fire incident was not simply a tragic footnote in the life of the man and prehistory of the nation. It was a pivotal moment in the Forbes campaign and in Washington's development. The first time Washington heard bullets whistling past him in 1754, he wrote that he found, quote, something charming in the sound, end quote. But his last combat experience before the American Revolution was a sobering reminder of all that could go wrong in the fog of war. The French and Indian War had presented the young officer with catastrophic defeats, grinding attrition, personal frustration, and tragedy, even as he became a heroic figure in British America and, in the end, triumphed over the French. When the Revolutionary War began in 1775, Washington was under no illusions. He braced himself for a long and protracted war that would leave America, quote-unquote, drenched with blood. By contrast, the British generals opposing him blithely assumed the American rabble would be quickly defeated after one campaign. Perhaps the greatest lessons that Washington absorbed from the French and Indian War and the Friendly Fire incident concerned the chaos, unpredictability, and human cost of war. To finish off today's program, we will read a few Ask Smithsonian questions. You've got questions, we've got experts. Why is the Midwest covered with prairies instead of forests? Jun Wen, chair of botany at the National Museum of Natural History, responds, "The Midwestern prairies used to be forests. This shift likely started between 20 million and 28 million years ago, and it accelerated during the last 5 million years. Possible reasons include a drier climate with more natural fires, as well as the appearance of larger animals. Herbivores such as elk and bison needed a complex digestive system housed in a large body to derive nutrition from grasses. These big animals also tended to form herds, which made it easier to defend themselves against predators while migrating long distances to stay fueled. Their grazing played a role in preventing large trees from returning to the Midwest. Another question is, do humans need to consider the environmental impact of building on the moon? Martin Elvis, senior astrophysicist at the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard and Smithsonian, says, back in 1967, the international community came together to sign the Outer Space Treaty, which banned countries from claiming celestial territories or placing weapons on them. Nations were allowed to claim samples their astronauts brought home, but space itself was declared, quote, the province of all mankind, end quote. The treaty didn't focus on environmental impacts, but in 1984, a group at Los Alamos National Laboratory noted the moon, unlike the Earth, has no atmosphere, which means it has no systems like wind, water, and erosion to erase scars on the land. As scientists prepare to place powerful new telescopes on celestial bodies, many are working to prevent the spoiling of these sites. The International Astronomical Union, of which I am a member, is considering these issues as part of a working group on astronomy from the moon. The United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space is in the midst of a five-year study whose goals include, quote, the preservation of a safe, secure, and sustainable space environment, end quote. Another question, when did the early colonists stop sounding British and start sounding American? Mary Lynn, former linguist of the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, answers, people back in England noted the quirky new ways Americans were speaking English within roughly a generation of the colonists' arrival. Over time, the changes went beyond accent to include different words and grammatical structures, adding up to a new dialect. Dialects have two main causes. The first is isolation. Early colonists had only sporadic contact with the mother country. The second is exposure to other languages, and the colonists came into contact with Native American languages, Mariners, Indian, English, Pidgin, and other settlers who spoke Dutch, Swedish, French, and Spanish. All of these languages influenced American English, as did the English-speaking colonists' origins in different parts of England, Wales, and Scotland. Later, as metropolitan centers such as Boston and New York City had more contact with England, they adopted the then-trendy R-less accent of the English upper class. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.